Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
As we know, during the Civil War, a tragic period in our history, the pro-treaty side were under pressure from Britain to defeat those who opposed the treaty and the new Irish Free State. But new documents show the lengths the British government was prepared to go to ensure the Free State succeeded, and paint an uncomfortable picture of a chilling Irish request from the provisional government that, if granted, would have changed the course of history. Using secret military reports, cabinet memos, private correspondence and dusty old diaries, journalist, broadcaster and former politician Michael Portillo is shedding new light on the key events and personalities of this most fraught time. His documentary, Taking Sides, Britain and the Civil War, airs this week, and he joins me on the line now. Michael, good morning to you.
Hello, Claire.
So in this documentary, you go right into the heart of the British government in that time leading up to and during the Irish Civil War. So explain firstly how you managed to do that.
This is the latest in a series of programmes that I've made with RTE, in which we use British cabinet documents, military orders, letters between leading personalities. We sometimes call these the enemy files from the Irish point of view. This is what is going on at the heart of the British government during key moments of Irish history. And in this case, we're looking at how, for example, the British spied upon the Irish delegation that came to negotiate the treaty at the end of 1921. And in particular, we investigate the extent to which there was collaboration between Winston Churchill, who handled matters after the treaty had been signed for the British government, and Michael Collins, a leading figure in the provisional government, how there was collusion between them so that the British could ensure that the pro-treaty side won. And some of the revelations, I think, will be painful and certainly were very, very surprising to me.
Now, you mentioned there collusion between Winston Churchill and Michael Collins, and we get these tantalising glimpses throughout the documentary of the nature of their relationship. Can you tell us a bit more about that? How would you characterise it?
There were similarities between the two men. They were both men of action, including military action. They were both men who were perfectly prepared to use violence. They were both charismatic. And I think Churchill, obviously a much older man, admired Collins in some way. He had, of course, referred to Collins and Collins's associates as the murder gang before. So it was a complex relationship. But I think that Churchill was somewhat struck by Collins when he had dealings with him in London during the protracted negotiations. Collins was a charismatic figure who actually also cut a swathe through British society, extraordinarily enough. He was feted in British society. When Collins went back and found, of course, that the treaty was not accepted by De Valera and by others, and as the Civil War got underway, Churchill was intensely anxious or suspicious that Collins might not be relied upon to take the necessary action. For example, the four courts in Dublin are occupied by anti-treaty forces, and Churchill is very impatient with Collins, trying to get him to throw that garrison out, regarding the garrison there as a breach of the treaty. He does, however, also say, Churchill, that he wants Collins to take care of himself, that he's worried that he's in danger of being killed. Of course, he is killed about 3 weeks after Churchill writes that. And I must say, Churchill adapts very quickly to Collins's death. At first, he's worried that the people who come after Collins may not be robust, that they may make some kind of deal with De Valera. But actually, with people like Cosgrave and O'Higgins coming in, it turns out that Churchill is highly satisfied with these people, who seem to be more robust in defence of the treaty and more willing to use violence against fellow Irishmen to secure the treaty, even than Collins.
Let's talk about some of those astonishing revelations that I mentioned at the beginning here. So these detailed plans that you and your team found, which tell us that after the treaty was signed, so this is while Rory O'Connor and those opposed to the treaty, they'd occupied the forecourts. And Winston Churchill had very seriously considered bombing the entire centre of Dublin City. Tell us more about what you found.
I don't think it's quite fair to say the entire centre. I think he wanted to bomb the forecourt, where the anti-treaty forces were. And I think that is clear because Churchill begins by saying, I don't want Irish pilots to do this because they won't have the accuracy. They won't have the experience of flying these aeroplanes and they'll kill men, women and children. So Churchill was, I think, considering a precision bombing of the forecourts. Now, whether a precision bombing was a possibility in 1922 with the state of technology then, I leave it to you to imagine. But Churchill had planes ready. We know that the planes which were stationed at Collinstown practiced bombing. They were Bristol bombers. They were capable of carrying a number of 20-pound bombs, although the British military doubted whether that would be effective and wondered whether much bigger bombs, up to 500 pounds, could be used. Although, again, I rather wonder whether the aircraft would have been capable of carrying such a bomb. More than that, Churchill wanted the planes to be disguised as Irish. He wanted to paint out the RAF roundels so that the Irish Provisional Government could claim that it was bombing the forecourts. This was typical behaviour of Churchill, this extraordinary gung-hoism, this extraordinary willingness to use extreme violence. And it's one of a number of instances in the programme where you heave a sigh of relief that Churchill's plan is not actually implemented in the end.
Because clearly it would have led to catastrophe, Michael. And do you know why it didn't go ahead?
I don't think we do know exactly why, but from time to time, wiser counsel, wiser heads win the day. And I think that's probably the case here as well. I think probably at some point somebody says to Churchill or maybe another minister overrules Churchill that could only be Lloyd George. But anyway, it doesn't happen. What does happen, of course, is that Collins is eventually spurred into action. And so the fact that Collins bombards the forecourts using, by the way, British 25-pounder guns, means that the British don't have to do the job for him. I might say here that those who'd occupied the forecourts, I think, very much wanted the British to attack them. They wanted to unite Irish people by being attacked again by the British. And Churchill is in constant danger of falling into that trap. And he narrowly avoids that trap, by which I mean that he persuades Collins to do the bombardment rather than the British.
And then you have this fascinating record, which appears to show that Churchill attempted to have his involvement in that planning destroyed.
Yes, in an incident which, you know, at least in Britain, has sort of resonance today, this relationship between ministers and civil servants. Churchill leaves office towards the end of October 1922 because the coalition collapses and he's a liberal and he's ousted by the Conservatives. And then he remembers that he's drafted a proclamation which was to be read out in the event that the British soldiers who were still in Ireland seized control of Dublin because they'd given up on Collins. Now, as I say, that didn't happen. Collins did what the British wanted him to do. The British didn't have to do the job themselves. And then as Churchill has gone out of office, his mind goes back to this proclamation that he's drafted saying that they've seized the city again and they've arrested everybody and they're going to do with them whatever they want. And thinks that's rather unfortunate, that document. You know, it looks as though it associates Churchill with what would have been a momentous blunder. And he asks the civil service if they'll destroy the document. And the civil service decline to destroy it because they think it's an important part of historic record. Mm-hmm. Quite an interesting incident.
That's fascinating. It's fascinating. And then going back to the plan in the first place, I suppose the one thing it does demonstrate is just how much pressure Michael Collins was under, Michael, to quell the anti-treaty side.
Yes. I mean, the Irish were threatened by the British repeatedly. I mean, one of the reasons that Collins and Griffith signed the treaty in the first place is that Lloyd George in London tells them very bluntly at the end of 1921 that the British will go back to war, unless they sign the treaty. Now, I would reckon there was a fair amount of bluff in that. But if so, you know, Collins and Griffith accept that. They sign a treaty which does not give independence to Ireland. It doesn't give a republic. It doesn't give them back the north. So it's a treaty which, from their point of view, is very unsatisfactory. On the other hand, they think it's the best they're going to get. And they take it back to their Irish colleagues and recommend it. And then after that, you know, the British always hold the possibility of going back to war as a threat to put pressure on Collins. And so, you know, Churchill tells the House of Commons very clearly that he thinks the occupation of the forecourts by the anti-treaty forces is a breach of the treaty. And that means that it's open to the British to take whatever action they want because the treaty is now null and void. And that means effectively war. And no sooner has Churchill said that to the House of Commons than Collins takes decisive military action and seizes the forecourts.
Mm-hmm. And then this other big revelation that you have in there, this request that you discovered from the provisional government of the Irish Free State to the British government asking for poisonous gas.
Yes, let me say as it appears. So this is a cabinet paper, and the cabinet paper says that the Irish provisional government, we're still talking about the siege of the forecourts, has asked for gas grenades. Now, it's not entirely clear what sort of gas they're talking about, but the British government clearly thinks that they may be asking for poison gas, because the British government immediately reviews a thing called the Washington Convention, which has been drawn up after the First World War with a view to stopping the use of poison gas. It's not actually been ratified, but the British nonetheless feel bound by it. And the British cabinet quickly concludes that it cannot supply poison gas to the Irish provisional government. It then goes on to consider what other kind of gas it might supply. And actually, I don't cover this in the documentary, but in the end, the British do send gas grenades to Ireland. They're sort of nearer tear gas. If you've got a spectrum of you know, horrible gases, they're nearer to tear gas. But when the when those grenades arrive in Ireland, the British government decide that even they are against the Washington Convention, and actually the provisional Irish government is never even told that the grenades have arrived in Ireland. But it certainly appears that the Irish provisional government requested gas from the British to help end the siege of the forecourts.
Yeah, appears might be the operative word, because how sure can we be of the provenance of that claim, Michael? Is it attributed to an individual, or is it just attributed to the Irish government requesting something? Because we haven't seen the request, have we? We've seen the response to it.
I haven't seen the request. That's perfectly true. What I've seen is the cabinet minute, and the cabinet minute refers, I think, to the Irish provisional government.
Now, you found documents that made mention of the Minister for Justice, Kevin O'Higgins, and I think you mentioned him here a little earlier too. What did those documents say about him? Because you did explain to us the fears that were there once Michael Collins was shot at Béal na Bláth, who was coming after him, who would do this job and keep the peace from a British perspective. Kevin O'Higgins then, what was the British government's view of him?
Well, the view of Kevin O'Higgins and of Cosgrave was that the British government was delighted with them. These were people who were really getting the job done. And there was an element of surprise. I don't think British intelligence about these people was particularly good. They hadn't realised, for example, that, you know, Cosgrave was from a pre-Republican generation of Irish freedom fighters. And they just thought that what they were doing, decisively winning the war, decisively triumphing for the treaty, was you know, all that they could hope for. By contrast with Collins, about whom, you know, they had anxieties and doubts all the time.
Mm-hmm. You make mention of the fact that Kevin O'Higgins signed the death warrants of 77 anti-treaty fighters, and that poignant fact that that included the death warrant of his best man, Rory O'Connor, who we mentioned before had taken control of the forecourts.
Yes. I mean, I feel in a way it's almost not for me to comment on this. I think this is, you know, this must be a very, very painful matter for Irish people. And one of the Irish historians I speak to in the documentary mentions that perhaps even more shockingly than the signing the death warrant of your best man is signing the death warrants of many ordinary soldiers, very young men who were lined up and shot. And I think the policy of the Provisional Irish Government was that if they suffered a military setback, they'd secured Dublin, but they went on fighting outside Dublin, where the anti-treaty forces were stronger. And so the Provisional Irish Government would suffer setbacks. There would be ambushes. They'd lose soldiers out on the road. And they would then, by reprisal, shoot men that they held in custody. So it is very shocking, a very, very deplorable period.
Well, you've touched on something interesting, you know, your own attitude to this story and just how careful you have to be, I suppose, in tone and in the words that you use. Are you always aware of that in making these programmes?
Well, I hope so. It is very, very, very sensitive terrain. And when we began making these documentaries some years ago, we called them the enemy files. I wanted to make it perfectly clear that we were talking about British documents, we were talking about British attitudes, and I was speaking as a member of the British establishment. I hope, nonetheless, that that I have chosen language which is suitable. And I've often been critical of the British government for many things, although I think the principal thing of which I'm critical of the British is their neglect of Ireland, their ignorance of Ireland. You know, Ireland is generally way down the pecking order of British concerns. You know, British ministers are more often than not concentrating on other things. And that is why, you know, quite a lot of things go badly wrong in our history. But yes, indeed, I'm aware of the sensitivities. I'm also aware that I think this program, more even than the ones that I've made before, is really on extremely delicate ground.
Mm-hmm. Is it an indication, Michael, do you think, of UK attitudes to Ulster that Lloyd George at that time calculated that the British public could potentially accept war over the Crown and the Empire, but not over Ulster? And he later encouraged Churchill to stick to the high ground rather than the swamps, as he said.
Yes, I think that's very interesting. It says so much about the two men. I do regard Lloyd George as a giant of a statesman. A pretty tricky character, I dare say, a man you wouldn't necessarily want to trust, but he really is a sort of colossus. And he does understand things at the strategic level. And, you know, looking back at it, I guess he's right. You know, you could say to the British people, these Irish, you know, they won't give the oath to the king. They want to leave the empire. That would seem catastrophic to the British people at the time. But to say to them, oh, well, we're quibbling about how many counties should be in Northern Ireland, in Ulster, that would seem very difficult to the British people. And again, there are sort of echoes of this in the present day, are there not? And then the contrast is with Churchill, who has his great moments of diplomacy, but also has these, you know, rather longer moments of being this gung-ho man of action without much consideration of the consequences. And Lloyd George, we see in the correspondence, constantly having to constrain Churchill, luckily with two or three successes, I think.
Michael, thank you very much for joining us on the programme this morning.
Claire, thank you so much.
Taking Sides, Britain and the Civil War will be broadcast on RTE1 television tomorrow night. That's at 9:35. And in the next hour, Professor of Modern History at UCD, Diarmaid Ferriter, will join me with his take on that interview and that documentary. So tune in for that in the next hour.